From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Maggie Comer never got an education, but she saw to it her children did. One of her sons, James Comer, is now a leading educator and child psychiatrist. Coming up, James Comer tells the story of a black family that fulfilled its dream, his family. Also today, leaving the comforts of home to learn lessons from the wilderness. Paul Gruchow's new book, The Necessity of Empty Places, is a collection of essays about the American landscape. Critic at large Laurie Stone reviews Michael Motion's new one-man show. Laurie calls it a combination of juggling, dance, magic, and human sculpture. And our rock and roll historian Ed Ward has an appreciation of the late Roy Orbison. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. James Comer says that the media and scholars are obsessed with black family stories about victims. He thinks that we can learn more about overcoming obstacles by studying the stories of survivors. He offers his own family memoir as an example. His new book, Maggie's American Dream, opens with an oral history of his mother. She grew up in poverty and was denied an education, but she saw to it that all her children were educated. Her five children have acquired a total of 13 college degrees. Comer devotes the second half of his book to his own story. As he made his way through grade school and college, he carried the burden of always having to prove that blacks were capable of academic achievement. Comer's mother always told him that the way to get ahead was through education. He became an educator and child psychiatrist in the hopes of helping black children get the opportunities he'd had. Comer is professor of psychiatry at Yale Child Study Center. He created an experimental program that develops the social skills of elementary school children. After being credited with turning around two schools in New Haven, his program was adapted by other low-income, predominantly black schools in New Haven, as well as by several other cities. James Comer, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. My pleasure being here.
I'd like to know, when you first asked your mother to sit down with you and tell you her story, what kind of reaction she had.
Well, she wasn't sure that she had a story that was worth telling, but she was willing to do it because I asked. And I really didn't have a book in mind at the time. I was just doing a family record for my own children because the story of my father and that interesting area of Comer, Alabama, where he was from, was all gone because the old-timers had passed away. And so I was just going to do a family record until I realized there was a larger story there.
Now, your mother really has an incredible story. She lived with her mother and her stepfather on the outskirts of Memphis. They lived in poverty. And the day she turned 16 and could legally leave home, she ran away.
Right.
What conditions were so bad at home that made her want to run away so much?
Well, she had a very good father who, until 5 years of age, when he was killed by lightning. And then at that point, there was no safety net, and a man came along who said he was single, but he actually had another family in Memphis, and he took the family from Mississippi to Memphis, and they lived from house to house. They'd find empty homes or empty shacks and move into them, and they moved like vagabonds from place to place. And then at one point, they went up and down the river on a houseboat, and she was like a prisoner on that houseboat and lived in little shacks. And he was abusive, and he beat the family, and he wouldn't allow her to have an education or any of the family to have an education. And it was just miserable conditions all the way from the time she was six or so until she was 16.
She ran away to East Chicago, where one of her brothers had already run away.
Right.
When she was 16 and she got to East Chicago, she enrolled herself in an elementary school where she attended school with eight-year-olds. Why was she so determined to go to school?
Well, she always believed that education was the way out for her. Even when she was a little girl, she felt that the education was a way out from the abusive conditions. In that period, poor people and middle-income people lived in the same neighborhood. So she used to look out and see better-educated people going off to better jobs, and they had better cars and better homes and so on. And she said, I want to be like that. And so education became important to her. And she never allowed the abusiveness of her stepfather to beat her down or to convince her that she wasn't able to achieve or acquire things at a higher level. And I think that was largely because That first 5 years with her good father gave her a real sense of self as a positive person and good self-esteem. And so with her stepfather, she kind of bounced off of him. Whatever he stood for, she was for the opposite. And he was against education, therefore it must be good. And she could see what it did for other people, and she was determined that she was going to have that for herself. Now, when she couldn't get it for herself, she vowed that if she had children, all of her children would get an education.
And indeed they did.
That's right.
The man she married, your father, came from a very different background.
That's right. His family was from a church background, and it was much better organized. They were also a family that lived under the better conditions of slavery. The slave master was a reasonably progressive person for that period, and his son was the governor of Alabama in an earlier period, and my father had positive relationships with that family, and the Comer families, black and white, had reasonably good relationships. And there was, I know his grandfather was a minister and his father was a minister. And there was a church culture that was very positive, and all of that was very organizing. On the other hand, my father only had a seventh grade education.
You know what I found very interesting? Your mother, when talking about her husband, your father,
yes,
frequently referred to him as Mr. Comer.
Right.
And this is when she was talking to you, her son.
Right. Well, I deliberately kept that in because that really conveyed her feeling, her respect for my father. Mr. Comer was the way she felt about him. He was a man of great dignity, and he was very caring, and she had great respect for him, and that's the way she felt.
Well, they both had a dream to make it. What was your mother's dream? You called your book Maggie's American Dream. What was her dream?
Well, my mother felt that we could all gain a college education and have better opportunities in life, and that she could make that possible. And that was her dream, that she and my dad together would make it possible for all five of us to achieve an education and have an opportunity to participate in the mainstream of American society.
She was so alert to the idea of always learning that when she was a domestic before the children were born and she'd go into the homes of white women to clean, she said she'd think of that as going to school, and she'd always pay attention to how things were done in that house to see if she could learn anything from it.
Yes, that's right. That was part of her plan. It was like she had a strategy for getting ahead, for gaining what was necessary to be successful in the mainstream of society. And part of that was to find out how the mainstream worked. And she worked for the highest socioeconomic families in the city and learned their ways of doing things, their ways of relating to the larger society. And she brought those home and used those in rearing her family. Now, she didn't accept everything. She didn't consider them better than her. There were certain things that she observed that she decided she did not want for her children, particularly arrogant, disrespectful behavior on the part of middle-income white children that she was caring for. On the other hand, there were certain ways of working, ways of performing that she observed, ways of working, caring for the children. She decided she wanted that for her own children. Now, she brought that home, and also our family was well organized and a part of an organizing and supportive church culture. And I think that combination of our own black church culture and what she took from the mainstream of the society kind of enmeshed our family in a network of experiences that were very important in helping us achieve our goals.
My guest is James Comer, and he's a professor of psychiatry at Yale Child Study Center and the author of a new family memoir called Maggie's American Dream. Now, your parents were very strict, and you know, even the neighbors would sometimes mock your mother for being as strict with her children as she was. And I wonder what it was like for you growing up. These are things we frequently appreciate more in retrospect than at the time. Were you ever a little embarrassed by how strict your parents were, or a little frustrated at it?
Well, sometimes we were embarrassed, and sometimes we were angry. And yet, we had good times at home, and so my mother's insistence that we come home at a certain time, you know, it'd be frustrating to have to leave basketball games or leave standing on the street corner talking with the guys to come home. On the other hand, there were four of us about the same age and my older sister, and we had good times. We had debates at home, and there were a whole variety of things that we did at home that were very exciting. On the other hand, there were times when she made you pretty angry. I know there were times that she would tell me things and insist that I do things certain ways, and I would pretend or act like I didn't like that, didn't believe that, didn't think it was a good idea, and I'd go away giving her the impression that I wasn't going to do it her way. But I figured out very early that my mother was often right, and so as soon as I'd get away from her, I'd do it the way she suggested. I just didn't give her the satisfaction of knowing that I did it her way.
Since she was so absorbed with the idea of getting a good education, if you brought home grades that were that didn't quite make it, would she punish you, get angry with you?
No, she never punished. She would show dissatisfaction, but most of the times we made very good grades. It was only in college where I had strange grades one semester. There was very interesting interaction. One year I came home with two A's, a B, and an F, and I was really very frustrated and angry and disappointed and upset and confused, and I couldn't really figure out what was going on. And in part, what was going on was the racist incidents and so on that I was dealing with in college that really confused me, that made me begin to do self-destructive things. And so I had stopped studying physics about halfway through the semester and gotten an F in the course. Part of that, as I look at it now, was really a test of my mother and her feelings about me. My feeling had been, a part of me felt that the only reason she cared about me was for my performance and what we achieved and accomplished. And when I got that F, my mother said, "You know, your grades are uneven, and I know you can do better." And she wanted to find out what was going on. I was so confused and upset, I really couldn't respond. She finally said to me, "You know, it's important for you to do well, and we want you to succeed. We want you to become a doctor, but your health is the most important thing." And that was the thing that really kind of took the monkey off my back. I knew then that they cared about me, and my achievement was secondary. And that really freed me up and allowed me to go back and take on all of those difficult circumstances in college and also achieve at a high level.
When you were in public school, you went to schools that were predominantly white until black students from a nearby overcrowded school were bused in. And then when you went to college as an undergraduate, it was also a predominantly white school, Indiana University.
Right.
And you said it wasn't until you got to college that you were really aware of the fact that you were from a lower income background, and that the fact that you got good grades in public school wasn't going to necessarily mean anything in the larger arena of college.
Right. Well, good grades in elementary school and high school were really protective because people respected you for that, for your ability, teachers, students, and so on. And you really didn't have to deal with the fact of being black and from a low-income background. There were no implications, negative implications, for the most part, although there were some racial incidents in elementary school, middle school, and high school. But for the most part, they were minor. In college, there were lots of people who were good students and good athletes and in lots of activities. And so those things that protected me in elementary school and high school were no longer protective in college. And so I had to deal with lots of racial incidents, sense of rejection without the kind of protective things that worked in school. First day on Indiana University campus, a half block off the campus, I was thrown out of a sweet shop because I was black. Second day, we went to an orientation session, and it rained. They came up with cars, administrators, teachers, and picked up the students who were standing in rain. Two white students got in the car. I got in, and the rest of the white students refused to get into the car. They preferred to stand in the rain. Those were just devastating kinds of experiences to, as a freshman, frightened in the first place and so on. That and many other things really got me off to a bad start. Well, I was about to recover. Uh-huh. And I had a composition course where I was doing very well. The papers were graded anonymously by the professor, and he was reading one of my compositions as an example of an A theme in the classroom. About halfway through, he had a question, and he asked, "Whose paper is this?" And I raised my hand, and from that point on, he ripped the paper to shreds. Everything was wrong with it from that point. And all of those things together were just devastating to the point that really made me have a very difficult first year. And then up and down over my period at Indiana until that incident that my mother really helped me deal with and helped me go out and then achieve at a high level.
Well, you decided to attend medical school at a black college. You went to Howard University for medical school.
Yes.
Why did you want to do that?
Well, I had just kind of had it with all of the things you had to deal with. It wasn't enough to be a good student, and it wasn't enough to be a good person. There was something else they were asking for, and I didn't have it. And so I was tired of having to prove something all of the time, and so I decided to go to a predominantly black school. As I pointed out in the book, that being a black student at a predominantly white school was like playing all of your home basketball games on an away court. That instead of getting cheers for your performance, you often got jeers and worse. And I was just tired of it. And so I decided to go to Howard. And yet, at Howard, I realized that all the problems of the world weren't racial, and that there were a lot of people problems. And on the other hand, Howard was a very good experience in that it introduced me to a lot of other blacks who were high achievers, who were committed to trying to bring about change. It introduced me to high-achieving black professionals, and so it was a good experience. Both experiences together were very important to me.
Well, I want to talk about your work as an educator, how you became an educator, and what kind of experimental programs you've designed. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is James Comer. He's a professor of child psychiatry and author of the family memoir, Maggie's American Dream. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is James Comer, and he's just written an autobiography of his family titled Maggie's American Dream. It tells how his mother, who was uneducated, raised five children and made sure they went to college. They all became successful, and James Comer has become a leading figure in the field of education. He's a professor of psychiatry at the Yale Child Study Center and associate dean of the Yale School of Medicine. You had planned on becoming a medical practitioner. But then you turned to child psychiatry and to education. And I was wondering if you could explain what was responsible for that change.
Yes, when I finished medical school and did my internship in my hometown, I began to do some moonlighting during my internship, and I was exposed again to the black community much more. And I began to see a level of poverty that shocked me. People were depressed. Many of my own friends who had been bright and able people in high school were on a downhill course in life and depressed and living under terrible conditions. And I began to ask myself, what's going on here? And rather than going into general practice, I decided to go into the service to give myself a chance to really think about what was going on and what I wanted to do. While in the service, I got involved with a volunteer agency helping people who had been thrown off of public welfare. And I remember a youngster going off to school asking his mother, who had been moving from one place to another, and all of their goods were out in the front of this house that we had. The youngster went off saying, "Where will I find you this evening?" And it occurred to me it must be very difficult to study when you don't know where you're going to find your mother in the evening and concentrate and to commit yourself to learning. And there were a number of other incidents that showed the insensitivity of schools to some of the problems of low-income children. One youngster crying in a corner, when I asked him what was wrong, he said his teacher told him that if he couldn't bring a dime back for the Easter egg hunt, he should not come back. I went out to NIMH as I looked at the stress these families were under and the children were under, and it was clear to me that these were bright children, but that if they didn't get a good education, they were going to end up on the day labor market that was right across the street. So I went out to see what they were doing in National Institute of Mental Health to try and prevent such problems and kind of stress the children experienced and their families were experiencing. And they convinced me to join the Public Health Service and go on to the University of Michigan to get an MPH, and eventually I went into child psychiatry with the notion that maybe we could prevent the problems that children and families were experiencing if we could get to the children very early, and then realize that the place that you could do that, and really the first place in our society, was in the public school. And that's why I began to look to the school as a place to make a difference.
You created an experimental program that was first started in two New Haven public elementary schools. When you first entered those schools, you were really unprepared for the lack of control that the teachers were able to get over the children and for the chaos that ruled in the schools.
Well, I was totally unprepared because my own experience had been so very different. I didn't understand what was creating the kind of conditions, the chaotic conditions, the anger that the parents had with school people and the school people with the parents and the custodian. And it was just chaotic, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. And eventually, I had to apply the knowledge I gained growing up in my family to that situation and using my training as a psychiatrist, and that combination really made it possible for us to bring about change in that school.
When you say apply the lessons that you learned in your own family, do you mean look at what you had, what you thought these students might not have had,
and figure out
how to give it to them?
So
how did that translate in terms of the program that you designed?
Well, I know that as I looked back and asked, what was the difference between me and, say, my three buddies that I went off to school to kindergarten with, who were from the same neighborhood, black youngsters, just as able, just as bright. The difference was I had received a home experience that gave me the skills and the confidence to go into the public school, a demanding school serving the highest socioeconomic children, and present myself in a way that elicited a positive response from school people. Also, my parents had the ability, when there was a problem, to go into the school and interact with school people in a way so that when they came out, things were better off for us. And I realized that that was very important, that the relationship between home and school had to be a good one, because both the parents and the teachers are a part of the motivation process for the children. Children imitate, identify with, and internalize the attitudes, values, and ways of their parents and their children, and that's how they learn, and that's how academic learning becomes important to them. It's through that relationship.
How did you get the parents more involved in the school so that you'd have them more involved in their children's lives and you'd have them on your side?
Yeah, well, you had to create a condition of mutual trust and mutual respect, and what we did to do that was to create a governance and management body made up of parents, teachers, and administrators, and our mental health team people, and also non-professional support staff. And that group together planned the academic and social program of the school. They all had a stake in it. They all got to know each other as people with mutual interests rather than enemies, and so trust and mutual respect began to develop.
How do you deal with troublemakers now? Do you have a different way of dealing with the troublemakers than you think the average public school does?
Well, we didn't look at them as troublemakers. One of the problems for low-income children or children from families under stress is that they grow up in environments where they are prepared for conditions in that environment, but not for the mainstream school expectations. A child might be told at home that you've got to fight if somebody bothers you. You're told at school that you can't fight. And so many other things like that cause the children to go to school presenting themselves in ways that get them into trouble.
So that's what you mean by teaching them new social skills.
That's right. And not only behavior, but not only not fighting, but many, many other things. The other thing is that too many people think of learning as a kind of mechanical process. You know, you turn on your learning machine if you want to, and you turn it off if you don't want to, and that is just willful not learning. Learning is really a relationship issue as much as it is a kind of cognitive mechanical process. We learn in part because the meaningful people around us want us to learn. There is no difference between a nonsense syllable and an A. The only reason a child learns that one is useful and that you make it in a certain way and pronounce it in a certain way is because a meaningful other, a caretaker that's meaningful to you, wants you to learn that. And so the relationship is critically important, and that's what we did in our school program, was to change the climate of relationships, create a good climate, make it possible for the children to have good relationships with the adults around them, and for those adults to be in agreement. And because of that, the children in our school program went from being 32nd and 33rd in achievement, 19 and 18 months behind by the fourth grade, to being tied for third, tied for fourth highest achievement in the city, and also best attendance records and no serious behavior problems, because we changed the climate of relationships and made it possible for them to achieve.
Do you ever find yourself paraphrasing advice that your mother gave you and passing it on to students now?
I find myself all the time. As a matter of fact, while interviewing my mother, we were talking about child rearing once, and she began to sound so much like me, and I've written a child care book, and I panicked, and I thought maybe she's not giving me her own opinions. Maybe she's telling me something she read in my book. Then I realized my mother doesn't have an education, and she doesn't sit around reading books, and that, in fact, I had been reading her book, that much of what I believed and understood and understand to be effective in working with children really came from my own personal experience, and that I was applying that and I had modified it or so, but that these basic ideas really came from her own child-rearing ideas.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us a little bit about your family and about your work as an educator. Thank you.
Well, thank you. My pleasure.
My guest has been James Comer, and his new book is titled Maggie's American Dream, The Life and Times of a Black Family. It's published by New American Library. Comer is a professor of psychiatry at the Yale Child Study Center, and he writes a column for Parents Magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Broadway lyricist Sheldon Harnick. He wrote the lyrics for Fiddler on the Roof, Fiorello, and She Loves Me, which has recently been digitally remastered and released on CD. I hope you can join us.
She loves me, and to my amazement, I love it, knowing that she loves me. She loves me, true, she doesn't show it. How could she, when she doesn't know it? Yesterday she loathed me, bah, now today she likes me, ha! And tomorrow, touch her. I'm speechless, for I mustn't tell her.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In his wilderness essays, Paul Grewchow writes of magnificent vistas and towering mountains. He also writes about mosquitoes, being lost, bad camping food, and coming down with altitude sickness. Coming up, Paul Grewchow talks about his latest collection of essays, The Necessity of Empty Places. Also, our critic at large, Laurie Stone, reviews a new one-man show by Michael Motion. He's been called a new vaudevillian, but Laurie thinks he's different from the rest. And rock historian Ed Ward has an appreciation of the great singer Roy Orbison, who died a few days ago. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. And as you can hear, I've got a bad cold, so don't get too close to your radio. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. For the third day, Southern California was hit by more damage from fires fanned by the hot Santa Ana winds. The San Fernando Valley near Los Angeles sustained the most damage as a 3,000-acre brush fire drove residents from their homes. More than 20 houses were damaged or destroyed in the blazes. Schools were closed and evacuation centers were set up at campuses and a synagogue. However, no serious injuries have been reported. Palestinian guerrilla leaders say an Israeli commando attack on Palestinian bases in Lebanon ended in failure today. One Israeli officer was killed and three other Israelis were wounded. Authorities say eight guerrillas died in today's assault. An Israeli spokesman said the nine-hour air, sea, and land attack was aimed at bases and the headquarters of Ahmed Jibril and his Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. A military curfew on the entire Gaza Strip and a general strike in the West Bank has effectively shut down the territories. As a result, both are reported relatively quiet today on the first anniversary of the Palestinian uprising against the Israeli occupation. Arab League Representative Clovis Maksoud said Arab delegations to the United Nations will propose a resolution which would be the first step toward worldwide recognition of an independent Palestinian state.
It is now an observer liberation movement. We are now going to try and get a resolution that would make Palestinian state an observer member of the United Nations, like Switzerland and the Vatican and others.
The Palestine Liberation Organization is now one of two groups with permanent missions to the UN. There have been talks in London between a British government minister and a senior official of the PLO, the first such meeting in 5 years. Vera Frankel has more.
The fact that today's meeting took place at all suggests that Britain sees a significant shift in PLO policy. Since 1983, the only contact between the two sides has been at the level of officials, because Britain has insisted that the PLO meet certain preconditions before higher-level talks could take place. Now it seems Britain is satisfied by PLO assurances that it renounces all forms of terrorism and violence and recognizes Israel's right to exist within secure borders. The PLO official who took part in today's meeting, Bassam Abu Sharif, a senior aide to PLO chairman Yasser Arafat, repeated these assurances at a news conference after talks with a Foreign Office minister. The PLO official, who said he was speaking for the PLO leadership, also said his organization supports a political solution to the Arab-Israeli dispute based on existing UN resolutions. The British minister welcomed Mr. Sharif's statement and said he hoped it would be confirmed when Yasser Arafat addresses the UN in Geneva next week. The Israeli embassy in London, meanwhile, has said it regrets today's meeting and has accused the PLO of engaging in double talk and ambiguity. For National Public Radio, I'm Vera Frankel in London.
The U.S. Agency for International Development confirmed today that all five crew members on board a chartered DC-7 were killed yesterday when their plane was shot down by a missile over the Sahara Desert. The plane, taking part in locust eradication efforts, was flying over territory held by the Polisario Independence Movement when it was attacked. A second plane was also shot at but managed to land safely. An AID official said there had never been any threats to U.S. chartered flights flying over the area in the past, so there was no reason to avoid the region. State Department spokeswoman Phyllis Oakley said it's still too soon to tell who is responsible for the attack.
There is an investigation now which is ongoing. There is no way I can speculate about who did it or how it was done until this investigation is completed. We are working with the FBI on this question.
A U.S. team investigating the incident said today that the plane was shot down squarely in the middle of territory that the Polisario uses to stage missile attacks. You're listening to National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Roy Orbison's almost operatic voice inspired a generation of musicians. Last year, he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Orbison was enjoying a successful comeback, performing his old hits like Oh Pretty Woman and In Dreams, as well as new songs. But Tuesday night, he died at the age of 52. Our rock and roll historian Ed Ward has this tribute to Orbison.
That voice could only belong to one person. Roy Orbison had a voice like no other. And really, the voice is all most of us know about him. He dressed in black, wore sunglasses, and didn't talk much. Recently, though, he seemed to be coming out of his shell, playing more frequently and recording with the superstar-filled fun band, the Traveling Wilburys. I wonder if the Wilburys reminded him of the Teen Kings, the band he'd had back in college at North Texas State in Denton. By the time he founded them, he'd already had years of experience singing on the radio around his hometown of Wink, a Texas oil boom town where his dad worked in the oil fields. With a couple of his North Texas classmates, Roy wrote a song for the Teen Kings that he was sure would be a hit, and, like his fellow West Texas star Buddy Holly, went to Clovis, New Mexico to record it.
Hey, baby, jump over here when you do the ooby-dooby. I just got it in there, ooby-dooby, ooby-dooby.
As Ooby Dooby took off, Orbison wanted to put it on a big record label, and Johnny Cash, who appeared on Orbison's local television show, suggested he try Sam Phillips at Sun Records in Memphis. When Roy called, Phillips dryly reminded him that Cash didn't run Sun Records, but changed his attitude when he heard the song. Orbison recut it with the Teen Kings backing him, and it became a mild hit in 1956. But Sam Phillips thought Roy Orbison was a rocker. Orbison knew better. He sounded best on ballads and was writing a bunch of them. He got a songwriter's contract with Acuff Rose in Nashville and a recording contract with Monument, the label that was associated with it. He and his songwriting partner, Joe Melton, were headed to Nashville to record one of these ballads when Roy got the idea that Elvis would probably do it better than he would, so they stopped by Graceland to play it for him. Elvis was asleep, though, and nobody could wake him up, so Roy wound up recording it himself.
Only the lonely.
I doubt Elvis could have done a better job, although the song only went to number two in 1960. In 1961, Orbison hit the top.
Just run and scared. Each place we go. So afraid that he might show. Yeah, running scared.
Running Scared had two things going for it. Its inexorable bolero beat and its out-of-control paranoia, which teenagers experiencing the roller coaster ride of love for the first time immediately identified with. And there was that voice. Orbison and his producer, Fred Foster, knew the tricks. Modulate to a higher key in the middle of the song, build tension, and let that voice float above the mass strings and background singers, as he did in this virtuoso moment. Throughout the first half of the 60s, these tricks stood Roy Orbison in good stead, even when the material was a little schlocky. He continued to be popular, not only here, but in England, where, in 1963, he toured with the Beatles at their request. Ironically, it was the Beatles and the bands who followed in their wake who spelled the end for the first half of Roy Orbison's career. his big-scale pop approach fell to the guitar combo sound. He was still popular overseas, though, and toured Europe frequently. Then, in 1966, he and his wife Claudette went for a spin on their his and her motorcycles when a careless driver hit Claudette and killed her. Orbison had just about recovered from that when, 2 years later, his house burned down with both of his children trapped within. By then, his records had stopped selling, and he had become reclusive. It wasn't until Bruce Springsteen let his admiration of this great singer be known that people started paying attention again. Orbison began to tour America, and audiences were surprised to discover that he was better than ever. The last time I saw him, he sang that end section of Crying 4 times as the audience went wild. The look on his face said, "Hey, I can do this all night." And he did, up until a couple of nights ago, when his notoriously bad heart gave out on him, silencing that voice forever.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. Mountaintops, deserts, and lonely coves are sometimes described as empty places, and to some people, empty means useless. Paul Grouchow finds it essential to leave the comforts of home and take time to experience the wilderness and these empty places. When he returns home, he reflects on the new landscapes in his essays. His new collection, The Necessity of Empty Places, is about his outings to the Sand Hills of Nebraska, the Blue Mounds of Minnesota, the Bighorn Mountains of Wyoming, and other places in the West. Grouchow lives on the prairie of southwestern Minnesota. I asked him if there are specific times in his life when he needs to head for the wilderness.
Well, I think the feeling hits me most often in the summertime. Partly that's a throwback to the days when I lived on the farm and when I understood, we were taught this vigorously from the beginning, that in the summertime, decent, honorable people were out doing some sort of physical work. I find it's very hard for me to write in the summer. It always has been, because I think I ought to be out doing something. And so in the summertime, I find myself heading into the hills.
I'd like to ask you to read a passage from your book. And I think this passage gives a sense of one of the things that appeals to you about picking up and leaving.
I like the idea of life lived at the edge. A spruce tree at the upper limits of the mountain tree line, thick and misshapen, shorn of its branches on its windward side, no more than shoulder high, although it may be a century old. Such a spruce speaks powerfully of the persistence of life. Every person who enters the wilderness goes in search of the same speech. A journey into the wilderness is a test of the will against the odds. Going into the wilderness, any wilderness, is a way of opening yourself to the possibility of danger and to the likelihood of discomfort at the least. There is the possibility of getting lost, of being trapped in a storm, of confronting an angry animal, of falling. There are the certain hardships of arduous walks, of exposure to cold, heat, wind, rain, of sleeping on the ground, of solitude. To be alone is sometimes the most difficult challenge of all. It is, in itself, an art for which we are ill-equipped, both by training and by experience, to confront the unknown and to meet its challenges is to be admitted into a permanently enlarged world, just as the tortured spruce tree at the edge of the upper forest enlarges and frees the world for trees, so our encounters with wilderness widen and free us.
You know, one of the things that interested me about that passage is that, you know, I think of some people going out into the wilderness for real macho reasons to see if they can conquer, and others for more meditative reasons, and I kind of put you in the more meditative category, but in that passage you really talk about the challenge, about the test of will against the odds.
I think one of the things that we often miss in our lives, although I must say I feel that when I go to a place like New York City, is the sense of fear. Most of us live our lives in comfortable cocoons. We go from houses to jobs, and if we survive the office politics, we know that we can survive life as a whole. But we really need to feel, I think, challenged by that physical world, and we just don't get it in everyday life. So I really do think that's one of the reasons to go into the wilderness, although, as you say, I don't like that macho stuff that sometimes gets sold. I don't think going into the wilderness and racing against time and climbing the highest mountains and doing it in the shortest amount of time, that sort of thing doesn't appeal particularly to me. I think the best way to go into any wilderness is the best way to go into a landscape, no matter where it is, and that's slowly and with your eyes and ears open and with your sense of touch alive and to experience second by second what happens there.
Do you see your essays fitting into a larger literary tradition?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a tradition that was started by Gilbert White in 18th century England and carried forward in this country first by Thoreau and then by a long line of wonderful writers coming down into this century toward such writers as Lauren Isley, a wonderful Nebraska writer, I think, who ought to be much better known, and to modern people like John McPhee and Annie Dillard. It's a great tradition, and it's a tradition that is really sort of left out of our cultural life in some way. It doesn't get into the science departments of universities, because it's not quite a science, actually, this natural history stuff, and it doesn't get into literature departments because it's not conventional literature. So it's a sort of lost force in specialized terms, but one that's very much alive, I think, in our literature, and an important one. Mm-hmm. I see myself very much as part of it.
One of the chapters in your new book is about going mountain climbing with a friend.
Yes.
And as you got higher, you both got altitude sickness. Your symptoms were a pounding head. His symptoms were an upset stomach, severe diarrhea. I'd like you to read the passage right after you described his symptoms and your symptoms and the increasing distress you were both experiencing.
The gruesome truth of walking in high places, yes. The art of wilderness walking is the knack of adjusting your expectations to reality, of taking circumstances as they come. You enter the wilderness expecting to find the expansiveness of space, the intimacy of caverns, the solitude of rocks, the music of birds, the silence of stars, the fragrances of flowers, the depths of waters. And you do. But you also encounter fogs and mists, sudden rain showers, the whining of mosquitoes, the bites of flies, trails that disappear, rocks that stub your toes, the cloying heat of midday, the gnawing cold of midnight, lumpy beds, aching muscles. One gray morning, you awaken unrested, pull on your stinking socks, find that the stove won't light, force yourself to eat a nauseating breakfast of cold instant oatmeal, which you remember now that you have always hated and can't imagine why you brought, and surveying the skies, see that you are going to spend the day walking in a drizzle. This is the litmus test, the moment when you expect a good companion to say, without a hint of irony, "Well, ready whenever you are."
Well, this story has a happy ending. You and your friend make it to the summit. You have lunch there and then head back. But I was wondering if you ever turned around, if you ever felt overpowered by the symptoms or fear or the discomfort.
Well, there's one occasion when I was walking in the Beartooth Mountains on the Wyoming-Montana border, and somehow had gotten myself hopelessly lost, and had wandered for 3 or 4 days through that wilderness with 2 maps in my hand, one for the Wyoming part of the wilderness and one for the Montana part of it, uncertain which map even to look at because I didn't know what state I was in. And it got very cold. It got down into at least the low 20s and started to drizzle, and I was lonely. I'd been on the road for a long time and terribly miserable. And I did turn back finally. I figured out where I was and got myself turned around, and I was absolutely headed out of that wilderness, and I was never going to go into one again in my life. And along the way, I stopped at a wonderful alpine lake, and the sun came out, and a raven came to entertain me, and the world looked sweet, and I was lost again, and the mosquitoes had gone away, and I went for another 5 days.
As much as you love different landscapes and the outdoors, you really hate nature shows. You're very critical of nature shows. And I want you to explain your criticisms.
Well, they serve a purpose of a kind, I suppose. They get people excited about a subject that certainly I'm very much interested in. But I think there's a lot of trivializing that goes on in that sort of program. There's a tendency to suggest that nature is an amusement and simply a set of amazing oddities. And the sense that we really need is the sense that we ourselves are part of nature, that we're one with it, that it isn't something we look at from a distance with a vague sense of interest, but something that we embrace, something that we recognize as we recognize members of our own family.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Paul Gruchow's book of essays, The Necessity of Empty Places, is published by St. Martin's Press. He spoke to us from KSJN in St. Paul. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a look at what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, are you doing any follow-ups on the earthquake in the Soviet Union?
Yes, we're expecting to hear from Moscow and as best we can, either direct or indirect accounts from Yerevan, the Armenian capital, today. Devastation just seems to be incredible. Perhaps 100,000 dead.
Well, today is the year anniversary of the Palestinian uprising. How are you covering that?
It is. Deborah Amos has a piece on what's happened now, a year after the protests really began in earnest down in Gaza and on the West Bank. Also, following Mikhail Gorbachev's speech to the UN and his lunch with President Reagan and Mr. Bush, we ask, is the Cold War over? And we hear some interesting answers.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Michael Motion is one half of the performance duo The Alchemedians. His partner is Bob Berkey. But our critic at large, Laurie Stone, recently saw Motion in a new solo act, and she has this review.
Michael Motion is part juggler, part magician, part dancer, and part sculptor. He's been dubbed a new vaudevillian. The recent work of other new vaudevillians, particularly that of the clown Bill Irwin, has become dreary, really exercises in frustration that point up the artist's embarrassment about arousing pleasure and awe. But Motion isn't embarrassed, analytic, or postmodern. In his 90-minute solo, Michael Motion in Motion, he uses the means of art, especially visual, abstract art, to give us something fresh and original. He lets us see his rapture and invites us to share it. He gazes at crystal balls with the love that a dog person lends a pet or a parent a child, and we're reminded that there is no getting over the beauty of certain natural facts. He juggles flashily, 2 balls in each hand, then 4 in the air at once. A single ball is allowed to roll down an arm and under his chin, then glide across his hand and around his fingers so it seems weightless. The ball appears suspended in place as Motion dances away from it. The image makes sport of time, aging, the pull that etches lines on the face and draws blood from the brain downward. In the course of the evening, Motion cavorts with hoops of varying sizes. He balances one 8 feet in diameter on his lip. Metal rods zigzag like crazed compass points. A pliant form suggesting a bicycle tire by Dolly is juggled like a giant piece of pasta, and two solid S-curved shapes become elk antlers, then designs that look like calligraphy. Despite the high-toned press coverage Motion attracts, his work is playful, improvisational. Early in the show, he works with silicon balls, bouncing them on the stage and against the walls of a huge triangle. The ping sounds the balls make alternately accompany and counterpoint David Van Tiegem's Lissom electronic score. Sometimes the balls move so fast they leave comet-tailed afterimages, and the collective effect merges computer graphics, percussion, and juggling. Sometimes the balls weave patterns that surprise even Motion, but he isn't unnerved by accident. It delights him as much as control, and a good deal of his magic comes from the tension established between discipline and improvisation. Physical skill grounds him, affording the peace that makes experiment possible. Technique is the raw material with which he shapes his art, and he looks to other practitioners not to appropriate an identity, but for roots and knowledge. Fan dancing and Lowry Fuller's light shows are remembered in his pieces. Working with sculptural forms whose shapes he keeps changing, Motion alludes to Kandinsky, Clay, Miro, and Calder. The same week I saw Motion, I went to a show of Richard Diebenkorn's paintings at the Museum of Modern Art, and I was struck by the way both artists show their fascination with geometry, physics, and architectural forms. Diebenkorn does it with erasures and pentimento, Motion with increasingly complex variations on themes. Both strive for originality by playing and testing until a new image is truly wrought. The majority of performance artists use ideas as starting points and hit walls. Motion begins his work as a boy tossing a ball against a wall, and his abstractions, always grounded in the physical reality of gravity and light, inspire wonder.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. What do you do when you're a confessional poet and you want to keep your privacy? On our next show, poet Sharon Olds explains how she handles that dilemma. Trumpeter Jack Walrath worked for Charles Mingus and Ray Charles before becoming a leader himself. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Walrath is a serious musician with a sense of humor, and next time Kevin reviews the Trumpeter's latest release. And television critic David Bianculli previews A Very Brady Christmas, a telemovie starring the original cast members from the early 70s sitcom The Brady Bunch. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Burton directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.